Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Tank Sinatra.
And I'm Investigator Slater.
And together we co-host a podcast called Psychopedia, which is a true crime podcast infused with comedy, making it a crimedy. Each week, Investigator Slater brings us a wild and thoroughly researched true crime case. I'm here to digest it all and react just like you probably are right there on the other side of the microphone.
Somehow, I've got to present each case with the detail and respect it deserves, while also cracking up at Tank's perfectly timed humor and thought-provoking questions.
Listen to and follow Psychopedia on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Betwixt and between a front here, a little bit of drizzle remaining, but that's going to clear up later on. And then highs today of 71 as one front comes through, and that's going to be later on this afternoon. Then highs tomorrow of 78, so we're near 80 tomorrow, Thanksgiving. About a 50% chance for showers. I don't know if they're quite sure on the timing of the front yet, but it's going to get a lot cooler after that. I would dare say cold highs Friday, Black Friday, only 59, 60 Saturday, 59 on Sunday. But wait, highs Monday of only 54 and lows Sunday night, Monday morning in the upper 30s, lower 40s. So not in time for Thanksgiving, but in time for December, we're getting some cool weather. Aaron Dusso joins us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the way the numbers turned out, the tally in the House and in the Senate. It's one thing to win an election, it's another to govern, right?
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you have as tight a majority in the House as they're going to have, you have little leeway to let people, members in purple districts kind of vote based on their district rather than the party.
So say that part again.
So, I mean, normally if you had, say, a 15 or 20 seat majority, what you're going to elect those members that are in those tight districts, the purple districts, you're going to let them vote against the party sometimes just because you want them to win re-election, and so that helps them. But when you've only got one or two seats, you can't let them do that, and so they're going to have a much more conservative voting record.
I want you to say that again because it goes sometimes to the show business of politics where – okay, we're going to give you a pass on this one. You're going to have to vote no, even though you would want to vote yes because of your district. You understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Right, yeah. I mean, this is it is a part of a show because when you run for re-election, you want to be able to point to, you know, achievements. You might want, if you're in a purple district, you want to be able to point to your more moderate stance than either, you know, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, than the current party. And so when you have this close of a majority, you're not going to be able to do that. And so you probably are going to be a little bit harmed, you know, come 2 years from now when you're running for re-election.
So let's talk about party loyalty. Well, first off, let's talk about numbers. The final total, as I understand it, 221, 214?
Right, yeah. So I think they call those last three, you know, districts just the last couple of days. But so, yeah, you're talking 218 is the majority. So you have a three-seat majority. This is tiny.
So given the fact that Donald Trump is president and loyalty is valued beyond all else, it would seem like does every Republican immediately jump in line no matter what the issue is? And that goes to what you were talking about before, because of loyalty. And if the president says yes, if the president says sit, you don't look for a chair, you just sit down?
I think that's what the president certainly wants. And I think that's what's going to end up being the leadership in the House is going to have to force that kind of compliance because they just can't afford to lose anyone. So, you know, these last couple of districts that were, you know, called, it's going to, you know, you might want to have a more moderate voting record, but you're just not going to be allowed to do it.
So when it comes to the Marjorie Taylor Greens, let me take a step back again with Matt Gaetz. Have they determined whether or not he resigned his seat in the previous Congress or in this one?
my understanding is that he resigned in the last Congress, and so you have this open seat, and he's not going to, he theoretically could take that seat again because he won it, in January, but he said he's not going to, so that's going to be left open.
So what does that mean? They have another that somebody's appointed?
Right. So likely it'll be an appointment until they can have a special election in Florida for that seat.
So when it comes to the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the I'm trying to think of some other real Trump partisans led to the former speaker being ousted. Now you got Mike Johnson from Louisiana. You got Steve Scalise from Louisiana, the majority leader, the majority whip, I guess. What is Steve's title? I got confused here. The speaker would be Kevin. No, the speaker would be Mike Johnson, right, Professor?
Right, and right, Steve right. Scalise, yeah. Because I think it's majority leader.
The leader, not the whip, because the whip is beneath the leader, right?
Right, yeah.
Majority leader, yeah. So those are two pretty powerful positions for two guys from Louisiana, a relatively, I guess, weak politically state nationally to have. But they are very, very loyal and attached at the hip to Donald Trump. Do these two guys stay in position?
I think they're going to stay attached to Donald Trump because ultimately the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world are going to take their marching orders from Trump. And so, I mean, what that really shows is that the president, and the House are going to work really closely together to try and accomplish the president's goals. There's not going to be an independent, I wouldn't think anyway, an independent voice in that room.
There are no independents elected to the House, right, as it stands now?
Right. Not that I've seen, no.
So with that being the case, it would seem to me like even if, and you can talk about, let me take a break. When you come back, you can talk about purple districts, if you will. And I guess that might be a situation where maybe they voted for Trump, but or maybe they voted for Harris, but they got a Republican in Congress. We'll talk about that when we come back. And it just seems to me, I don't know how anything, any scenario could play out, given the fact that the House, for the most part, Republicans are, I'm just going to say, terrified of getting on the wrong side of Donald Trump. First of all, if that's still a situation, does he still wield the same power that he did? And if that is the case, it would seem as though, with Mike Johnson being afraid of getting on the wrong side of a Marjorie Taylor Greene or what have you, or same with Steve Scalise, I don't mean necessarily negatively, I mean afraid politically, that maybe the president might have a rubber stamp when it comes to the House. We'll talk about it when we come back. Aaron Dusso, our guest, associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. And I'll ask you all at 504-260-1870, do you want your Republican representatives to fall in line and lockstep with whatever the president wants? Or if it's better for Louisiana, do you want them to go the other way? You can text me at 504-260-1870. Somebody texted and said, seems like the Democrats fall in line with the party more than the Republicans do. I think that's might be, you're looking at that through a partisan prism, but we'll see what the professor thinks when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Dusso, associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. The text comes in, Trump won popular vote in electoral college. He has a clear mandate. The people have spoken. You are on the wrong side of history, and I'm sure here comes your liberal professor. Your side lost. You obviously don't understand what a clear mandate is. Educate yourself. Well, 71 million people did vote for Harris, and I don't think that they have no voice in any way that the country is run, and they do have how many Democrats in the House of Representatives? It's not always the majority wins, right, Professor?
Right. I mean, the use of the term mandate is kind of, again, this is a pop discussion. It might be important on TV, but in the end, you still got to win the votes in Washington, right? And so that's what we're talking about with regards to the really close House. And so Donald Trump needs to keep his caucus in the House in line. And he's not going to, my guess is that he'll probably do a pretty good job of it because I think many Republicans don't want to be on the other side of his tweeting. And that's because that's a big problem for them.
So if that's the case, does he have a rubber stamp when it comes to the House?
I mean, rubber stamp, it might be a bit far, but I think he's going to, essentially make the decisions of what he wants to see. He certainly is going to consult with Johnson, Speaker of the House, about what he thinks he can get done. But in the end, it's going to be Donald Trump driving that show.
When it comes to the Senate, talk about that, if you will.
I mean, the Senate, they have a bit more leeway, 53. 53 seats in the Senate, so there's a bit more options there. But still, it's really close. Ultimately, once you get over the majority, what the next step is to get a supermajority so you can avoid the filibuster, and that's what they don't have. And so in the end, whether they had 50 votes and they can use the vice president to break a tie, or they have 53, is not that big a difference there.
So what is this likely to look like the next 4 years, given the, well, at least next 2 years, I should say, until the midterms, with the makeup of the House of Representatives and the Senate?
Right. I mean, those first 2 years, you're exactly right. The first 2 years are critical, and that's where they're going to push as much and as fast as possible. And that we've seen, you know, over the last several administrations that have come in with the majority in both the House and the Senate. They do, those first 2 years are critical. But what's interesting here, and I think it's a complete unknown, is how does Donald Trump handle the Supreme Court's willingness to say the president of the United States is immune when he's doing things that are part of his core powers of the Constitution, and overseeing the federal government, you know, and particularly the executive branch of the government, and all that bureaucracy is a core power in the Constitution. And so when he, you know, receives any pushback from Congress there, will he really exert that kind of power where I can just ignore the law?
What would that look like? Give me an example of that.
Well, so the key, you know, one I'm watching right now is going to be, you know, the budget. So Congress can appropriate funds, say, for the Department of Education to do stuff. But, you know, the Office of Management and Budget is within the executive office of the president, and that's where, you know, the power might lie to impound that money. Now, there's the Impoundment Act of 1974, I think it was, which would theoretically make it against the law for the president to impound those funds for more than 45 days. But it is part of his core duties, and so does he need to follow the law in that case? And then in theory, what he could do is simply say, I can starve the Department of Education, even if I can't completely eliminate, because that require an act of Congress. I can starve it so that it doesn't have any functioning anymore. And that would essentially be breaking the law, but he's immune to any, you know, law problems. So we'll see. That's fascinating to me.
I can't imagine a Republican in the House risking the wrath of Donald Trump.
I can't either, especially this close. You know, because every time it's happened, you know, the person has found themselves on the outside, right? So Liz Cheney, she is, you know, a Republican as Republican be, and yet she's on the outside of the Republican Party now. So if it can happen to Liz Cheney, it can happen to you.
Right. That's why I just think it's going to be more like a rubber stamp, but we'll see. Thank you, Professor. Have a nice Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. We'll talk to Aaron Bendeley about tax reform and the governor's measures that went through right now. Time for WWL First News. All right, 644, 16 till 7. Got a little front coming through, and then it's going to clear out later on today with highs only near 70 or so. We're going to be riding a little bit of a roller coaster, I guess, if you will, because then highs today are going to be around the area of 71 degrees, 78 tomorrow, near 80 Thanksgiving, 50% chance for showers, highs of 75. Then cools off a lot for Black Friday, highs of 59 on Friday, 60 Saturday, 59 on Sunday, then Monday, mid-50s. So you'll be able to get those jackets out, coats and sweaters and everything else if you remember where you put them. Aaron Bendeley joins us now, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing great. And you?
I am okay. Let's talk about the governor's tax reform plan, what passed, what didn't, what still needs to be looked at, and from the Pelican Institute's standpoint.
Well, we're really pleased. We think it was a good outcome. The legislature adjourned a little bit early last Friday. They had been scheduled to adjourn yesterday. So they concluded their work early, and they actually got a lot done that I think will really make our state more competitive. That was the impetus for calling this session in the first place. Governor Landry announced a bold plan to bring jobs and opportunity back to our state, position us to be competitive, and most importantly, bring our kids and grandkids home. And so we're excited that the legislature did that through a number of bills, a tax package that reduced a number of taxes, made our tax code fairer, less complex, and then a big piece of that we had been pushing, which is a restraint of government spending going forward to make sure that we begin to get our fiscal house in order and bring that spending back to a level that we believe is more sustainable for our people.
What did you say, bring our kids home? Tell me what specifically is in, I'm a little bit confused about that. You said bring our kids home, and what was the other one?
I was talking about bringing our kids and grandkids home, bringing jobs and opportunity back to our state. We have lost, as a state, we've lost over 120,000 people since 2016 alone. Mm-hmm. Every year consecutively since then, we have had more people leaving our state than coming in. I have friends and family members that have moved on in search of opportunity in other states. Many of my friends and neighbors and coworkers have similar stories. And a lot of that is because other states have done more to make their states competitive, where businesses want to operate, where families want to go in search of opportunity. And we're behind. We've got a lot of ground to make up.
The reason I ask is because, you know, that's a lot of that, I think, is kind of, with all due respect, anecdotal. And I get a lot of anecdotal texts here that come in. And to a point, they say it's the insurance that's driving people away. It's not tax reform. And I'm not trying to criticize what the governor said or what you're saying. I'm just thinking you got to factor insurance into this, don't you?
Absolutely. And that's not to say that the issues addressed in this fiscal session were the only ones that need to be addressed. Certainly, we have to address rising insurance costs. We have to continue to work to make our educational system top quality so our kids are prepared when they leave the K-12 education system. A number of issues that we still need to address. Regulatory reform is another one. But this is one in particular that there was a special focus on taxes on the state budget, because these are real policies that drive business and jobs and opportunities away. And these population numbers are real people. 120,000 people from Louisiana have left our state since 2016. If you look at just the period between 2020 and 2023, 84,000 people left our state. That's roughly the size of Lake Charles. I was there this past Thursday giving a speech to a group of people in Lake Charles and said, can you imagine your entire city being gone within a 3-year period? It's alarming, and we have to take that seriously.
Now that's real. That's not anecdotal. Those numbers are real, and I'm not challenging that at all or questioning that. I'm just wondering about, is there any way to really determine the role of insurance and triage with the reason for people leaving? Have surveys been done about that?
I don't know that studies have been done specifically asking what public policies have driven people's decisions to leave. I think most families will tell you it's a number of things. It's, mm-hmm. you know, again, this is anecdotal, but I think many will point to jobs. A lot of us know of people who have just received more competitive job offers and a chance to progress their career in other states, search of education opportunity, and overall lower cost of living. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Insurance is certainly a part of that. I know in my family, we got an increase in our homeowners insurance and our car insurance this year. We're encouraged that even though the legislature took some bold steps in tax reform and spending restraint, that they will come back next year and in the subsequent sessions and tackle some of those remaining issues, because this is just a start. This is a really good start, but as you mentioned, there are still other issues that need to be tackled.
And I'm not trying to imply that this is not going to lead to economic growth or development, but I don't know that you can look at this as it's just about tax reform and people leaving, and in my opinion at least, or about job opportunity without addressing the big elephant in the room, which is the rising cost of home insurance. And again, anecdotal, but that's just from the text that I get every day. We're talking to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President of Policy and Strategy at the Pelligan Institute. We'll look at it from a positive standpoint when we come back. And we'll ask Aaron, give us some examples of how the governor's the reforms that were passed and what needs to be approved by voters, how that could lead to our kids and grandkids coming home, economic development, and what the future of the state could look like. If you got any questions, 504-260-1870-650, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 656, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelligan Institute. So let's talk about, if you will, Aaron, before we went to break, we were talking about some positive examples of how the reforms that were passed could lead to, or are there companies that have expressed interest? Not quite quid pro quo, but if you do this, we'll come here. Are there expansions on the horizon for Louisiana businesses, as far as we know, because of the reforms? Tell me how what the future's going to look like, if you know.
Well, throughout the session, our Secretary of Economic Development, Susan Bourgeois, testified a number of times that because of our complicated tax code and our punishing corporate taxes on business, there are a lot of times that Louisiana doesn't even get put on the radar. We're not even in the mix when it comes to major businesses that are looking to locate. We certainly want them and need them in our state to provide jobs. We are ranked right now 40th in the state for overall tax competitiveness by the Tax Foundation. So we believe that where the legislature ended up will put us on the map finally in a pretty competitive way. So just talking about the corporate taxes alone, the legislature repealed the punishing franchise tax, which is basically a tax on the privilege of doing business in our state. Most states do not have this tax, and they certainly don't have a mix of the three corporate taxes that we have had for many years, which is a franchise tax, a corporate income tax, and a corporate inventory tax. We are one of three states that does that. So again, bringing corporate income taxes down to a more competitive 5.5%, eliminating that franchise tax, and beginning the process of hopefully phasing out some of those inventory taxes, we believe that will be great relief. And all of the economic development experts and our leaders testified that this will get Louisiana in the game of where we need to be.
Somebody wants to know about keeping score. They texted in about how would we know if these reforms work or not, if you have a time frame on that.
Well, it's interesting, and a lot of people, if they keep up with their state legislators, even on Facebook, I saw a number of them posting a graphic that shows Louisiana's relative position to other states when it comes to overall tax competitiveness and what has been their population increase, positive or negative. And so that's an interesting indicator that we can continue to watch over time. Just like in the world of sports, being competitive is more than just a one action play. We have to constantly reevaluate where we stand relative to other states. Even our neighboring states have been taking actions to position themselves as places where people want to go and where businesses want to go. We have to constantly evaluate where we stand to make sure that we stay competitive.
And you got to have a good special teams guy, a gunner, but you also got to have a quarterback, right? And I guess that goes to priority. So what can be done next as far as tackling the insurance crisis? What would the Pelican Institute like to see done there?
Well, a number of lawmakers have mentioned coming back next session. There's even been a little chatter of another special session. We'll see if that plays out. But a number of conversations going on about tackling insurance in particular. And again, that's not a one silver bullet recipe to address that. I think a number of things have to be done. I know the legislature has looked at roads. They have looked at possible tort reform. They've looked at a number of different things that factor into high insurance costs to try to get more underwriters here into our state and ultimately make our roads safer, make our drivers better.
Thank you, Aaron.